One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
This is Leslie Kane, and you're listening to That UFO Podcast.
So, touching again, you mentioned catastrophic disclosure before. I've just spoken a few nights ago to Danny Sheehan, and I brought up catastrophic disclosure to him because he mentioned one of the questions I'd asked him previously, he brought up being asked to sign NDAs, and he refused to do so. I asked him off the back of, you know, catastrophic disclosure, what's his understanding of that, given he won't sign the NDAs for the people who are worried about it, as to what they would think. And again, from his point of view, similar to what you mentioned, Matt, he's talking about, you know, the banking systems would suffer, that our societal fabric, as we know, would change. People waking up next morning, that would be a huge thing in people's mindsets. The big tech companies, you know, fuel would be... tech companies, aerospace, whatever, there's going to be an impact. So I wonder, with the revelation that these shadow programs exist, how do you see it, maybe one or two, three big ways, impacting society the most?
Well, I think it depends on what information comes out, right? Because there's two parts of what you might interpret as catastrophic disclosure. One is the impact of the knowledge of whatever the facts that come out on existing systems. And then there's the potential for the impact of, you know, NHI on our human systems, right? And those are like two different buckets. I'd say I'm higher confidence in sort of speculating about the former rather than the latter, because I don't have like high credence information on exactly the nature of the intent and capabilities of the proposed, you know, NHI or NHIs. But just in the former, I think we can model that relatively well, and at least given, you know, in interpolation between statements that, say, Jim Sevivan has given, John Ramirez has given, Carl Nell has given, and, you know, these folks are in a position to come to their own judgments. I'm not saying that they have like a crystal ball, but I think they are all indicating this is a very serious issue. There's no getting around this. You know, there are going to be some uncomfortable facts to reckon with, and that might require society adjusting in ways that it hasn't been forced to adjust in, you know, to certain facts before. And so that's where I'm, you know, focused a lot on in terms of thinking through the geopolitical, the financial, the social, you know, implications, and how we can sort of mitigate some of those, ahead of time. Naturally, you never eliminate risk, you just mitigate risk. And so, just, you know, and human civilization has been a fragile project on this rock. And so we have no guarantees of survival, even without this subject, right? We have narrowly avoided nuclear annihilation. I did a lot of work in my previous life on the systems the US government has established to ensure enduring constitutional government under, the most, catastrophic scenarios involving, say, all-out nuclear war. And so I've become, I wouldn't say inured, but like I'm used to thinking about scenarios where it's extremely not good. And so maybe that psychologically makes me a little bit more prepared to think about all sorts of disruptive scenarios for human society. Now, I think this could be, we're entering a decade of disruption where the existing balance of power geopolitically is becoming unsettled. Prospects of increased conflict are rising. The pace of change of technology is accelerating, and disruptive technology that existing state systems don't have a good handle on. The proliferation of disruptive capabilities to non-state actors is going to increase. The sense of social cohesion will continue to erode. So we're entering a period, NHI aside, of increased strain on the social, geopolitical, economic fabric. And so we're going to have to find a way through this decade, regardless. You could imagine scenarios where this discussion helps maybe reinforce some, maybe decaying anchors of our institutional paradigm and refocuses attention on things and, maybe bind social groups together in a way that they're currently, at each other's throats. That might be a bit Panglossian, but at least it's a potential. And I think how we make decisions on how we approach the subject in a serious, professional, and analytic fashion in context where it isn't dismissed or ignored are critical, because if you just ignore it until you can't, you're not going to be, you're not going to have the mental or conceptual sort of framework or furnishings to get your arms around it. And so I think different parts of society, both are, academic, obviously the Seoul Foundation has been pushing this direction, but also finance, risk management. We need to think about these disruptions that are going to be coming in from all the different directions. I wouldn't say I'm a pessimist or an optimist. I say I'm a realist and a pragmatist. And I think, human choices, still have a role in our future. I think there's certain folks in corners of whether it's high society or sort of technology accelerationists that want to hand human will to the machines and inaugurate a new paradigm where we become sort of epiphenomenal to our own futures. And I think we should resist that as much as possible and try to center human will and agency and responsibility. That's how I'm trying to anchor my view here. That was a bit more philosophical.
No, sure. And have you been fortunate yet, or have you managed to meet any of the leaders of the UFO discussion at the moment, whether that be a Lou Elizondo, a David Grush, who did a talk on Wall Street, I know, some time ago, Chris Mellon, Gary Nolan, any of these? Have you had any direct conversations with those types of people?
I have not met those individuals directly. I've had a number of face-to-face and in-person connections with folks similar to them and close to them. I'm not trying to kind of position myself as like at the center of the story. And I have like resisted trying to like become like a UFO influencer. I've basically been driven by professional curiosity. And then as I've gotten more information and developed high trust relationships, those people introduce me to other people and, I'll, give them my thoughts and my perspective on the subject. And if they want to introduce me to somebody else, I'm happy to have further conversations. And just through that kind of chain of introductions and discussions and conversations, it's sort of, through that network, gotten somehow into this world, but I'm not trying to, fish for any particular information. If they want to chat, I'm always happy to chat, share thoughts. I guess my only objective, narrow personally, is just to try to, you know, get my head around a wide range of these different issues so I can at least form a coherent picture of the future as much as I can, and then try to navigate, you know, myself, my family, my clients, and, you know, through whatever my public discourse supports kind of the larger social orientation towards this issue. I wouldn't say I have like enough sufficient inside information to chart like what I think the disclosure process should be. But I think it's going to be weirder than people think, right? And my background in physics and philosophy is like prime me to think about like deep questions. And there's like two core mysteries that I think the UAP subject will force us to reckon with that are deeply entangled, which is the nature of the structure of physical reality, right? We don't have a fundamental theory of physics. So we don't really have like a consistent mathematical framework that allows us to understand the relevant degrees of freedom that we could maybe technologically exploit or another civilization could technologically exploit. And the other key mystery is consciousness. We don't really have, I'm not a physicalist materialist, you know, I guess in a philosophical paradigm, I'm closer to like a proto-panpsychist, you know, neutral monism, sort of Russellian type picture. So we don't really understand the nature of consciousness or the role of consciousness in the structure of causation. So that's deep, but I think the UAP issue isn't just going to be a typical issue of like, oh, it's an, you know, we just sort of plug it into an existing puzzle. And there's just one missing piece and we just put that piece in there. It's going to be a different puzzle and we don't know how the pieces fit together because we don't fundamentally have a coherent model of reality that I think the UAPs will force us to develop. So the existing vocabulary and sort of folk philosophy and metaphysics and physics that we rely on, we are straining to cover over this phenomenon, but very imperfectly. And so the metaphors that we reach for, the fictional tropes that we have in our cultural imagination are the best we can do, but I think people shouldn't anchor too much on those frameworks. We're going to have to stretch them pretty significantly.
Yeah, I think, again, I'm not a physicist by any way, shape or form. I genuinely always planned on picking physics in school as a subject. And the genuine reason I didn't was the pressure put on me in my second year of high school when a physics teacher said it would be people like us who would have to work out how to deflect asteroids heading for Earth in years to come. And I just thought that sounded like a lot of pressure. And I was like, no, that's not for me. And genuinely, from that moment, just on that, I decided not to pick physics. But I'm not going to ask you, obviously, who. I'm not going to disrespect you by going, oh, who have you spoken to? But I wonder, are those folks that are in the public domain as such, or are you speaking to individuals in the background who haven't come forward yet?
I'd say most of the people that I've spoken with are not names on like UAP Twitter. You know, they may have, you know, tweeted about it. You know, they're known for other things. Serious professionals that are interested in, you know, have connections into the subject. Yeah, I'd say the most of my deeper, more substantive conversations where I've gained, I'd say, more of my information have been from individuals that are not, you know, active on Twitter or done UAP podcasts.
Sure. That's fair. I appreciate that answer. And on that, so going back to the What Bitcoin Did podcast, one of the hosts asked you about biologics, and you sounded like me for a moment, just with a much better accent, okay? Because they ask you, you know, what do you think these are? You know, are they aliens? And you go, and you say, you know, what are aliens? And he's, you know, things from other planets. And you go, and it's, you say it, it's suggestive and it's from a place of, I'm not saying direct knowledge, but you clearly have an opinion put together that it's too easy to say aliens coming from another planet. How have you gotten to that point? What sort of conversations or research or ideas have you seen or heard that you've went, do you know what? It's not aliens coming from other planets. There's something else to this. What stood out to you?
Yeah, it's like converging tracks of knowledge and speculation, right? That sort of, I don't have like a high confidence singular assessment of the phenomena in general. That was maybe related directly to the biologics that Grush was referring to.
Yes.
And that UAPDA was referring to. And that, you know, leads me along a certain line of looking at just first us as a human species. What are we on a technological course to develop? And if you just look at DARPA's 20-30-year plan, it's basically, you know, everything you would need to do to develop a synthetic biological organism, right? whether it's a convergence of AI, robotics, synthetic biology, genetic engineering. Like we already are pretty close to creating synthetic life. We can grow small little sort of organoids, sort of mini brains in a dish, mini hearts in a dish, mini organs in a dish. This is not sci-fi. Like this is the current roadmap of our R&D paradigm. So like if I just extrapolate that out, right, it seems pretty natural that human species will be generating synthetic life forms pretty soon, probably in my life, right? All things being equal. And so that is just like, I don't have to speculate about unknown physics in terms of, say, some tension parameter that's, in the Einstein field equations or some, breakthrough in a QBR drive, space-time metric engineering sorts of stuff. I just have to look at our current high-confidence R&D pipeline for AI, robotics, synthetic biology, and it's pretty clear you get to synthetic biological organisms. And so that seems like a pretty convergent technological paradigm for any species. It doesn't require leaping ahead to any unknown physics that we currently don't understand. And so that's like I'd say in general, right, if you encounter an unknown biological creature that's not from the known phylogenetic tree and you associate it with a craft that seems to be, manifested from an advanced non-human intelligence, my like default assumption is that the biologics you encounter in that craft are not going to be the progenitor species that engineered that craft. They're going to be engineered functional organisms that perform a certain role in concert with that engineered, more material technology. That's basically our current technological track. And so that's like the baseline, like a priori reasons. And of course, there's been folks maybe giving more hints along that line, but whether Gary Nolan has talked about them as like biological avatars, and I respect his opinion. He certainly is close to the subject. So that's, circumstantial, but it leads me in that direction. And I think, we have certain cultural anchor points, that have been developed as a result of our sort of Hollywood and fictional portrayals of the subject. And it's all about ET with certain, endogenous morphologies that just, evolved from their home planet and they're just here. That could be, I'm not eliminating that as a scenario, but at least, it seems more likely if we were embarking on similar expeditions, we would be engineering all the materials going along with that.
You mentioned ET. In the next couple of years, we've got the new Steven Spielberg feature coming out as well, which is ET focused again. So that could be interesting timing if Mr. Spielberg, many folks have said for decades since Close Encounters, he was in the know. And there's a lot to that researchers, or people associated with the UFO subject have said is pretty spot on in terms of being, a movie as to the reality of what's going on. So for him to have something else coming out, almost 50 years after the last, maybe points towards something, who knows?
I mean, yeah, there's a great book. Most folks that I know haven't read it. It's kind of didn't make much of a splash, but it's called The Cryptos Conundrum. By an author named Chase Brandon, and he was a former senior CIA officer, and he finished his career as the senior CIA liaison to Hollywood, and then he retired and he went out to LA, became a script consultant, script writer. But he wrote a fiction novel, and I think published in 2012, if I recall, which essentially is a fictional portrayal of the 20th century and sort of near future of the CIA, intelligence community, layered in with essentially the Roswell alien plotline. So it's a sci-fi book. But his epigram at the beginning is essentially sometimes truth can only be told through fiction. I'm aware of certain elements in that book that he brings in that had to do with programs that I had touched that are non-public information that he sprinkled in and layered in with fictional materials that would be, you wouldn't be able to discern what was true or what wasn't true. And it is an interesting book, and it has been recommended to me by individuals as something to read on the subject. And that's the interesting reason I bring it up is that the protagonist in the book, who's kind of the CIA super spy that has an encounter and has special abilities and is sort of managing this program in the government. One of his collateral duties is to shape cultural portrayal of this subject throughout the 20th century. To sort of seed certain storylines and kind of fictional tropes to steer and implant certain ideas about the subject. And so, yeah, so I'm not saying that's what, Spielberg is doing, but it is consistent with, kind of the wink coming from the guy who wrote this book, who that was his actual job. And I know someone who worked with him in the agency who said, you know, he had a very unconventional career. This is coming from someone who themselves had a very unconventional career. So
I was literally writing down as you said that. What was it? Chase Brandon.
Chase Brandon. Okay. Yep.
And Crypto's Conundrum. Conundrum.
The Crypto's Conundrum. The Crypto's Conundrum refers to an actual statue in the center of the CIA that is has a cipher text embedded in it. That's a part of the plot. So
I've made a note. So thanks for that one. And I'm sure other folks out there are going to now message me going, what was that book? Who was the author? So I'll say it for a third time, folks. So I hopefully don't have to tweet it or email it. It was Chase Brandon and the Crypto's Conundrum. So I'll have a look out for that. It sounds like a good one. Let's get to some listener questions, Matt, in the time we've got left, because I got so many through for you. So apologies. And I do mean that, folks. It was as soon as this came out, loads of you got in touch. So Dave Smethers asks, and you'll have to speculate a little bit here, Matt. Okay. There's lots of rumors regarding something happening in 2027. What does Matt think of these, and has he thought what it may be? And obviously we hear a lot about some things coming, and we hear predicted years and whatnot. So any speculation as to, is 2027 the date for anything?
I haven't heard firsthand, enough information for me to live my life as if 2027 is some, inflection point. I certainly have heard enough information to feel as if we are prepared. We are entering a regime of accelerating change across many different dimensions. And this will be a key component of it. And I don't know exactly that will be associated with a date. I think I tend to resist, modeling the future as if there's going to be a before and after.
Yeah.
I tend to usually think that there, at any given point of an exponential curve, you zoom in, right? You can sort of get a sense of the immediate past, the immediate future being relatively continuous, although with a gradient. Just that gradient, accelerates over time the further you go up. But at any given sort of local point, there is a continuity between the past and the future. Only in retrospect or zooming out, right, do you get a sense of just how, of a dramatic change, was in play. So that's kind of how I think this will happen. It will not feel like a before and after disruptive, thing. It will be ideally, at least, this is my, maybe it's a bit of a hope, is it'll be more of a process that unfolds and that you sort of adapt to it. Maybe certain institutions and psychological frameworks don't adapt as quickly enough. So where there's a lag, there could be risk and sort of a snap that forms. But I don't know if there's I haven't heard with high confidence of like an invasion or something, yeah, or that there's like an agreement that expires and then all of a sudden, things just appear. I know that's been part of kind of the lore speculation. I have not heard anything to directly confirm that. But I have, I've drawn strong inferences from the title of Lou Elizondo's book, Imminent. That's not an accident. I also draw strong inferences from just the pace of effort by serious officials in the U.S. government to put in place a framework for this, which they state explicitly, which is in order to mitigate the possibility of foreign technology surprise, to open up R&D and science technological development and in furtherance of the public interest, we need to have this disclosure process. And so it could be that we worry about an adversary getting the jump on us and getting a geopolitical advantage as a result, maybe a psychological propaganda advantage as well. So there are other converging drivers in the global environment that could make disclosure or disclosure process become more likely to activate or more likely to obtain in more, in higher fidelity for a larger portion of the population. That sort of is my baseline, is that that's the trajectory we're on. I don't know when we'll hit like a threshold beyond which the average citizen will say, oh yeah, these programs are real. And oh yeah, NHI is real, right? And along that way, you've boiled water, when do you get to, 100 degrees C and you get a phase change? Those are usually very hard to predict. So yeah, I'm expecting a general increase in the salience and public discourse of the subject. There could be, more sort of high profile events that, kind of maybe in a more stair step fashion, kind of move it along. But I don't know if there's going to be a single 0 to 1, that's on the calendar.
I'm with you on anything date related, and I'll try and put this across in the right way. I've not really said this so much before, but anything with a date for me has to be very human driven. You know, if someone says, oh, 5 years' time, there's going to be a huge, even cataclysm, or, you know, aliens are going to reveal themselves, or whatever it is going to reveal themselves, I can't see another species literally sitting down with any of our leaders, whether it's, you know, presidents or whatever it may be, and saying, look, Tuesday the 12th of June 2027, we are going to basically unveil ourselves, so get ready by then. That's just not happening. So anything with a calendar and a date is going to be human driven if they've set that for whatever reason. And like you say, that could possibly be that the US think they have 2 years to get ahead of this before China does something, for example, based on X, Y, and Z. So let's give ourselves a rough ballpark date. So I'm very wary, yes, of any dates attached to anything. And again, even like times, for example, the end of the world will be at 12 p.m. Right? Okay, well, 12 p.m. is different places. So for someone, they're going to have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning for the planet to explode, which is going to be really inconvenient. So, wary of those kinds of things.
Like, I'm strongly resistant to sort of eschatological framing, right? Which I think tends to trigger a certain type of human psychological belief formation, which is kind of destructive. Because if you believe that there's going to be some impending doom or some impending revelation, I mean, disclosure, if you actually just translate the apocalypse, like apocalypse from Greek, means like the unveiling, right? Yeah. Or to disclose. So the language is itself a kind of eschatological language, right? That there is going to be an event beyond which there's some grand revelation. And, you know, us as community, as like people in the outgroup, the believers, will sort of have the I told you so moment. We will get the grand redemption. And the true believers may even be called up into heaven by whoever is this redeeming element. Yeah. That's a recurring pattern of human belief formation, and it tends to create, I think, you know, potentially destructive, self-destructive attitudes. And often you get, you know, cults that orient around such beliefs and, you know, commit mass suicide. So I'm very, like, resistant, you know, even if it's true. I mean, I don't think it's true, but, like, even if it is true, it's self-destructive to believe it, right? You have to, like, really check yourself. In spinning a certain vision that seems totalizing and imminent and you know, the sort of you know, it's very powerful. Like, you know, you have to like always like pressure test that idea and like you know, ground it. So that's just like how I try to focus on this.
No, I agree. All the Mayan calendar stuff, the calendar ends on this date, you know, that means it's the end of the world, but actually the calendar's reset, so all it does is go back to the start. Could that mean a new beginning? The end doesn't mean the world's about to explode, you know, and all that kind of stuff, and people panic. And on a similar type of theme, Stephen asks, is teasing possibly imminent breakthroughs and disclosure potentially counterproductive? If it's going to happen, we're going to find out anyway. If it doesn't, then it can lead to disillusionment. Is it better to not show your hand in advance to prevent countermeasures from the gatekeepers? Would that make sense to you?
Let me see if I understand it. Essentially, I guess the premise is you have some ace in the hole piece of information or individuals that will execute disclosure, and you are laying the groundwork for this plan that you will then spring upon, you know, the stipulated adversaries inside the government or in legacy programs, aerospace, and you don't want to give away your hand. If that was the case, like, that would have happened, right? It's like, I'm not quite sure that is the current state of affairs. I think the state of affairs is individuals that have experience with these programs that don't have all the information, but have some information, have come, you know, in drips and drabs to other officials in the government with like nominal legal and democratic responsibility over the public funds and official covert action and government research and development special access programs, and said, you know, this doesn't seem right and we need to investigate and get to the bottom of it in an accountable fashion. But I think a lot of people are also patriots and don't want to see legit security programs be compromised. And that's, I think, what Senator Rounds has said, is that this needs to be done in a controlled fashion in the furtherance of transparency and accountability while also protecting our national security advantages. And I find myself, you know, not having any other information to kind of support a similar view, which is, yeah, like the fact of non-human intelligence information is not something the government can classify. It's not government information, right? But U.S. government, you know, weapons or ISR platforms, sources and methods, that's government information, right? That's properly in our current system of government legal and legitimate for them to classify and not disclose. And so I think you do need this process of people to like, okay, this is something that is not government information that can't be held from the public. And this is a controlled process to make that information known in an accountable way. So I don't think this is like a, like a spy versus spy game. I mean, there's like elements of the counterintelligence issue, because I'm sure Russia and China are watching this very, very deeply. I know that even Jim Sevenman mentioned that, TTSA's computers were hacked as soon as they announced, and they had two Russian agents walk through their private group. So there are considerations here about beyond just the disclosure process, but how to protect those legacy programs, the elements of which connect to, valid and legit, national security related information. It seems like this is the only, this seems to be the best card we got, right? To kind of have this play out in a valid way. And there's some people who just say, burn it all down, let it all come out. That's fine. You can have that view. My disposition is to be more pragmatic.
So Easter Island, I was going to have this question in, but I'm going to give Easter Island the credit, because something you said on that podcast in the last 20 minutes, he says, or they say, because I don't know if he or she or whatever, I know he won't say, but can you ask Matt if the coup de grace figure to step out later this year, I'm guessing post-election, is either John Brennan or Leon Panetta? I have no idea who either of those are. And then they say, blink, one eye for Brennan, two for Panetta. Now, you you mentioned basically a figure known, I think your wording is known, if you watch the news in the US, would come out and talk about the UAP subject. That's what you alluded to, essentially. Is that right?
Yes. So I'm aware of one individual, and I have, the name has been told to me in strict confidence. And I'm not just saying this because like, oh, I know something you don't know. It's more like if you say the name, you could potentially, change the course of otherwise events, right?
Yeah.
You could, trigger pressures to be brought that, I'm sure this individual would not want to be brought. But it keeps in the logic that I was mentioning earlier in terms of David Grush opening the door to technology of unknown origin, biological materials, testimony to Congress. He was a relatively senior GS-15, but he's a 36-year-old. No one had ever heard of him before. He was like a mid-level bureaucrat, well-respected inside that community, and had all the credentials and tickets and accesses and obviously the knowledge to come forward in the way that he did. But fundamentally, he's David Grush, right? He's not another, person. Carl Nell, similar, but a little bit more senior, right? Was a retired colonel, but also an Army liaison to the UAP task force. Has, had more bars on his chest, and had held positions in private government and in private aerospace, CTO, et cetera. One notch, two notches higher from David Grush, right? You've had Christopher Mellon, endorse some of those same things. He was deputy undersecretary, or assistant secretary. You've had Lou Elizondo, who is a GS-15 as well. So you've had folks, with sterling professional bona fides, but are not, what you would imagine would be folks for the UAP Records Review Board would be, individuals with sort of national renown, right? Of national significance to come out and say those same things. And that is my understanding, an individual that would meet those criteria to be a potential member of the review board. That is the caliber of individual that is preparing to come out this year and say similar things.
Can you give me like a layman's example? So I know you've told me what we don't have, but is it like, I'm trying to think of any figure now that isn't controversial, and I keep thinking Oprah Winfrey, but is it like that level of person celebrity wise? I'm not meaning celebrity like Tom Cruise, but just name.
No, not like a celebrity, and not like, I don't know what Oprah would do or Tom Cruise would do, right? Yeah. But someone whose career would, if someone like this with that career said something like this, the Sunday morning talk shows would be like, what did that person just say?
Right. Okay. And it couldn't be something that would be overlooked. They would have to pick that up. That story would be run with.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, wouldn't necessarily be the, here's the craft, but would be this is a serious person with a very serious background that has held very serious positions of responsibility. And they're endorsing these claims. Well, why are they doing that? Maybe we should have an independent review board get to the bottom of this. Over to you, House. Let's get this passed. And you know, give it to the president to determine how best to get this information validated and out to the public. That's my understanding.
Yeah.
I've heard other names besides this one individual that could be coming out in concert or could be motivated by this other individual's move in the same direction, providing top cover for it. But that's my understanding. I don't have a specific time, just this year. So that's why I don't want to, get ahead of this person's information. I don't know exactly what they will say. But I think it behooves, and the reason why I said it is because I think it behooves other people to think about what could happen this year with that potential in mind. I always think about tail scenarios and, different branches of the future. And I try to collect information that allows me to establish credences over which branches are more or less likely to obtain, and then plan accordingly and give advice to people accordingly. Mm-hmm. And if there's information that makes a certain branch of the tree where an individual of this caliber says something like that, well, that forces me to then recalibrate my present decision calculus, and should likewise for others. Now, I'm not saying this will be like the grand disclosure, capital D, right? I don't think there is no, as I mentioned before, there's no single event, right? This is a process and it's a ratchet, right? And this is one next crank of the ratchet.
That's fair. My really crass way of thinking of that then is, you said you were a physics geek in school and I was really geeky in school. And if you were going to put on a house party, maybe you weren't the coolest kid that all the cool kids would come round. But with the endorsement of, this particular person, the others pay attention, want to get involved, want to be there, or they at least pay you more kind of credence. You get some cool factor from it. So,
yeah. And I think there's always a push and pull, I think. And I think you can draw this inference just from what the Senate is doing, just what Senator Schumer, Senator Rounds, you'll notice that Senator Schumer, Senator Rounds' public statements, aside from maybe the scripted colloquy was the one time they went a little bit further. But usually the interviews that, say Matt Laszlo does, which is, he's an excellent guy. You should definitely subscribe to his Askapol. Give him some money for that, because he's getting a lot of these folks on the record and really getting a sense of how they think about this. That's very high valuable information. And Senator Rounds in particular, who's obviously one of the stewards of the UEPD on the Senate side, they clearly don't want to have to talk about the details of the definitions of non-human intelligence. They'd much rather, and they always just talk about kind of the procedural stuff, right? This is where we are in the negotiation. We're going to do this manager's amendment. It's going to go into the package, yada, yada, yada. They never really want to talk about non-human intelligence, technology of unknown origin, biological materials. They don't want to have to say those words out loud. They want them to be in the text. They want the text to pass, and they want the review board to have to manage this issue, right? So they're trying to balance the necessary sequence of procedural and legislative actions to get this formal structure in place with not triggering a whole bunch of, media discourse, right? Yeah, a lot of people ask, well, why hasn't there been a whole lot of coverage of the UAPDA? And I'm pretty sure it's because most of the senators that are sponsoring this have turned down requests from major mainstream media newspapers to hey, why did you introduce this bill? Why did you, put this language in there? I think there's a curious silence on that subject because they're trying to strike this balance. And I think there's other individuals that maybe are reaching a certain point in their life arc that are just nope, this is the time. I'm going to help push this along. I know the senators can't say this, but I'll say it and give them a permission structure and help politically get this bill across the line. That's my read of the situation.
So on that, Kenneth Noisewater, great name, asks, can you ask Matt, when the next push to legislation potentially fails, are we looking at next year again, or could you see at that point something else happening, i.e. more whistleblowers or hearings? What are your thoughts on that? That we've had this one go at it, it failed. Second go, let's say it fails. Where do you see things going?
Yeah, I think there's always... alternatives, between individuals making certain calculations personally. At least I think there are folks that might be willing to come out publicly that haven't yet, if that fails, just to try to push this along. There's a separate track I know in the House, which is enhanced whistleblower protections. So they might be coupled scenarios in terms of UAPD fails, whistleblower protections also fail, or just UAPDA fails, but whistleblower protections go through. Right. And I think, you know, there's certain folks that want enhanced whistleblower protections.
Yeah.
And so that might determine exactly how much information comes out from additional individuals. And this is maybe a better question for folks like Carl Nell and Lou Elizondo. Because I think, you know, at the end of the day, there's also civil society here. And certain of this information is not government information and can be pursued in independent tracks. I know there's lots of, you know, investor interest in this subject, you know, and a recognition now that it's now that sort of the taboo has fallen among, I think, a sufficient number of folks, you know, in positions in the power structure that haven't been traditionally paying attention to this, that now are, that you could see independent initiatives stood up to, like, you know, of course, you've had things along this line, the Galileo project, but I think you could see an acceleration and expansion of those sorts of things, more and more kind of private sector activity on the subject, that pries things open in a separate way while continued government stuff happens. Yeah, I have no crystal ball. This is a highly contingent, you know, nonlinear thing that we're going through. So I make no pretensions to predict the future. But yeah, I think, you know, I think they're playing it the best hand they got, which is okay. Let's see, get the UAPD across a formal structure. That's what everyone, you know, in power wants. Hand the hot potato off. If you don't get that, I'm not sure there isn't much of a controlled process anymore. That's what Carl Nell said. It will be an uncontrolled process. And the definition of an uncontrolled process is you can't really predict it, right? So at that point, lots of different things could happen.
So something we've not touched on at all, from Cat Deer Duck, they ask, risk management is a large part or a large aspect of investing. Why isn't managing risk taken into consideration when the University of Ica in Peru are also doing disclosure by peer reviewing the non-human intelligence evidence? Of course, this is them talking about the Nazca mummies. Why, I take it you followed that element of this story that's been out since last year with these mummified bodies. What is your take on it, and why maybe haven't these had the splash a lot of folks wish they had?
I mean, I've tracked it, and to be honest, I kind of was overwhelmed by the competing narratives at play, and I have limited bandwidth and cognitive energy to like get to the bottom of things, and that's just something I haven't been able to like put into a sufficient amount of you know, analytic energy. I know some folks that I respect are paying close attention to it, are spending a lot of time and actually some resources to help support some of that research. But yeah, I'm sort of fundamentally agnostic and just sort of waiting for someone to come out with, you know, a declarative set of uncontested facts on the matter. Until then, I see it as maybe, you know, All power to them, right? Anyone who wants to pursue interesting questions, go for it. It's not something that I have, apportioned enough of my energies for to have a high confidence assessment on at this moment. So that's all I got. That might be a cop out, but that's where I am.
You're sitting on that fence. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, no, I am sitting on it. Like, I just literally, because I've heard people that I respect that basically that utterly dismiss it. You know, the individual associated with it being a fraud and these things being forgeries and the whole thing basically being a sham to raise money. I've heard that narrative. I've heard others basically saying actually there's a subset of some of these artifacts and that actually, you know, merit serious, you know, forensic pathological investigation and, you know, meet a certain bar of plausibility to merit, you know, scientific analysis, and that may be, being undertaken. I think there's folks that are pursuing that. I would say go for it, right? And I'll look to see the results. I haven't seen anything come out that says peer review sufficient to say, oh, this is meeting a certain standard of academic evidence. I've seen, you know, people make suggestions in that direction, people doing, you know, analysis of CAT scans and other sorts of morphological anatomical analysis. I'm not an expert, so I can't, you know, adjudicate those. You have two experts all basically saying completely different things.
Yeah,
and the rational response is sort of equipoise and suspending judgment, and then, you know, going off in other directions that maybe you can get more tractable.
Awesome, Matt. So just to wrap up, I want to ask you one more thing. Obviously, you're a young guy. UFO topic, I think, needs more fresh new faces to it as well. I know you're saying you've done some stuff the last year or so, but would you be interested in sticking around in the UFO topic using some of your professional capacity? For example, if that presidential review board went into effect, would you be interested in a position on that if it was offered to you, for example?
I'm not sure. This is like the, you know, the presidential hypothetical, right? Like, I don't entertain hypotheticals. I mean, so my professional track right now, I maintain a lot of different irons and different fires. The core is essentially helping, you know, C-suites and boards of directors navigate, you know, geopolitical crises and understand their security posture. And that's intellectually stimulating, professionally rewarding. Certainly, if this topic were to, you know, enter into this Overton window, you know, I would certainly engage in it to the extent that I can in a productive fashion. I sort of done that. Like, there's a four topics. It's sort of China geopolitics. That's like, that's certainly at the center of sort of DC and corporate risk management focus. And of course, that's where the disproportionate amount of my time and energy and cognitive capacity is dedicated, is because that's the center of mine. Obviously, it's where you get paid, right?
Yeah.
The next is like AI. So AI, I've obviously done a lot on sort of AI emerging technology assessments and risk management. And that has now moved from sort of outside the Overton window, where you're like, okay, is AI going to disrupt, you know, our political economy? Is it going to create job losses? Could it actually create catastrophic risk to human society if it isn't aligned and it reaches certain capability thresholds? I now sort of focus on that as well, integrated with my current sort of professional capacity. The whole Bitcoin thing, again, I've been doing this for a number of years. Assessments of Bitcoin, national security, you know, somewhat of a fringe niche thing. You know, it has been sort of moving to the center of the policy discourse as it has become more of a global asset class with geopolitical implications. And so I've engaged professionally with think tanks, helping produce sort of white papers and engagements with policymakers on how to think about the risks and benefits of this emerging phenomenon, something that they maybe didn't, you know, weren't prepared to think about in a serious way. And I view sort of the UAP topic and the NHI issue in the same way, essentially something that's coming in from, you know, the tails, something that's coming in from outside the Overton window that seems to be crossing various thresholds into serious policy discourse. And I just look around in the DC area and, you know, the traditional think tank apparatus and sort of the policy discourse, and it has not really penetrated. So there isn't a amount, really a number of people that are taking this seriously and getting kind of like getting their arms around this. So if it does, you know, if you get this review board stood up, I don't think there's like going to be a whole lot of like, you know, professional capacity in like think tanks at Brookings, right? So the extent that I can support that, I would certainly love to contribute. I'm not sure I would like drop my life and just do that full time. That would be a big jump. But I think that's the path that we're on. And this is where, you know, like, I'm not trying to become like a UFO influencer. I'm basically trying to become, you know, someone who other people, and I've had people talk to me, you know, folks that say have close relationships with the Federal Reserve, you know, serious positions of responsibility inside the Treasury Department, people that I talk to in the national security space that haven't been clued into these programs, but are now looking at this and seeing like, well, wait a second, like, this seems to be serious. And so I become like a sounding board for some of those individuals. And I detect essentially a gradual shift among, you know, very serious policy, you know, technocrats essentially in different parts of the government that are looking at what the Senate is doing and what they're saying and what folks like Lou Elizondo and other folks that have strong reputations are saying. And they're like, wait a second, there's no one that I know of inside my bureaucracy that sees this coming. I mean, I would point at one example of this was a great white paper that the Seoul Foundation released by Helen McCaw, who was a former financial stability analyst, you know, senior person at the Bank of England. And, you know, she's was paying close attention to this topic and realized that, you know, her colleagues that have responsibility for managing financial stability risk had no clue. And that's a problem, right? Like, you can't just ignore it, right? Like, it's, people have a sense of taboo and kind of, really, it's a reputational thing. And maybe because of maybe personal reasons, I haven't cared as much about like that, like personal taboo or sort of social cost. I've never experienced it. And so maybe I just don't care. Maybe there's like a little bit of like arbitrage, right? Finding a space that, because of those particular reasons, other serious people have not looked into. So it's like, you just go there and, you know, it's kind of like a blank field, right? And you can kind of make a contribution without much competition. That's kind of the motivation, and I see that continuing. There's a big gap essentially between the seriousness of the topic and the seriousness with which, like, the professional, you know, like the PMC class that runs most of our bureaucracies and media institutions and think tanks, you know, look at this. And I worry about that class actually more than anyone else in terms of adapting to this, because that class essentially in our society got to their positions of responsibility by having, assumed a certain position of authority and knowledge and competence to manage a certain domain. And so we put them as a business responsibilities. We ask them to, you know, make decisions about, you know, financial risk management, you know, national security policy. And the assumption is that these people know everything that they need to know to manage the risk and execute policy in their domain. And if it turns out that there's a whole set of risks and developments that they've just been ignoring, that they now have to, like, reckon with, that they've been dismissive of, that they now have to incorporate, that's a radical potential risk to our institutions. Like, I think anyone on the street could be like, oh yeah, I get aliens are, you know, whatever, NHI things, the world is weird, you know, probably true, right? Right. Yeah. But then that person goes about their day, right? Whereas the person who's in charge of managing the payment system, the intelligence system, defense system, you know, our healthcare system, these bureaucratic control structures, those people's worldviews, their sense of position in society could be disrupted. And we need those people to show up for work. We need those people to do their jobs and not to be, like, you know, taken for a loop. So that's I think more folks like Helen McCall need to come out and actually, like, pay close attention. So that's basically what I'm just trying to do.
Awesome. It's been really refreshing speaking to you, Matt. I'd love to get you back on when the time comes, because I think your position, your professionalism, your analysis, and, do you know what, your interest and passion for the subject kind of comes through. So that's really great to hear. So lovely speaking with you, mate.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That is all for this episode. Thank you very much for tuning in. Don't forget to leave the podcast a review on your chosen platform. Apple and Spotify do make a huge difference to the algorithm. If you're checking the show on YouTube, please don't forget to like and leave a comment on here as well. Any sharing you do is very much appreciated on any social media platform. And finally, you can listen to shows ad-free and sponsor-free in their glorious full versions by subscribing for less than the price of a coffee on Apple, Spotify, just search That UFO Podcast Premium, YouTube, you can sign up and be a member, or you can do that through patreon.com. Thank you very much for listening, folks.
It wasn't a tic-tac and not quite a saucer, more like a hubcap designed by Chaucer, a little baroque and quite steampunk, like Alice was playing bass for the Parliament of Funk. The little fucker hovered right outside of my window, and when I shoved out the screen, he made it an issue. I don't think he expected me to see his ass, but I'd had some champagne and smoked a little rat. Meditative game of state full on meta. Can't imagine how it could have been any better. I got to the top of the stairs and there he was. Like, you awake? I was about to abduct you, cuz. I jumped back and nearly kissed myself. Then I climbed out the window after the elf. And I woke up in my bed and there was something on my head. And everything was weird and everything was red. And I called up my boys. They thought this was noise. They thought it was a dream. They thought it was my toys. They thought it was my problems. And they think I should seek therapy. And I don't know what to do because it doesn't really scare me.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, PayLater, and all major cards. So you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loan subject to approval in available locations.